Monday podcast. I'm Merz publisher John Roerink, joined today by Mike Palat, Jacob Kanzler, and Simon Schuster. Guys, it feels like it's been forever since we've had a podcast. It hasn't really, but we recorded the last one the Friday before the 4th.
I miss the banter and the fodder.
Oh, me too. Me too. Surely we're going to sit down with Michael Limo, Executive Director of Clean Fuels Michigan. But before that, we have a new entrant into the congressional sweepstakes. That is the 8th Congressional District. That is one Alyssa Slotkin. Simon, you were there for her announcement. Tell us a little bit about her and what was your takeaway?
Yeah, she's quite a unique candidate. She spoke about being in New York on 9/11 and then how that inspired her to then enter the CIA as a Middle East analyst. And then she served 3 tours of duty in Iraq and then joined the Bush White House and was also held over as another civil servant into the Obama administration. Now, although she has this background and expertise in national security, her message is really just going to be 3 things: jobs and the economy, and then healthcare. And I think that this is going to mirror some of the larger congressional messages that we'll be seeing in the 2018 cycle, especially as we're still awaiting the fate of the American Healthcare Act. This is something that she's kind of staking as a primary theme. And she called for, in her announcement, that if the vote on the AHCA is to fail, she said that there should be a summit of medical professionals to determine what the best policy path forward is, because she did acknowledge that the Affordable Care Act needs reforms.
Okay. Mike, you worked in the 8th Congressional District as a reporter for a long time. This is the district that was represented by Mike Rogers, now Mike Bishop. Do you think he's vulnerable? This is a fairly conservative district, isn't it?
It is conservative, but there's large sections of this district that are outside of Mike Bishop's home base. I don't think he can count himself safe. He's really got to work that district and make sure that he's connected to the local communities. Livingston County, where Mike Rogers was from, has yet to adopt Mike Bishop as their hometown boy.
So there's room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Mike Bishop's biggest vulnerability is that he has not been seen in the district a whole lot. There have not been a lot of town hall events. He closed his Lansing office, and the fact that Mrs. Slotkin began her kickoff in Lansing shows that she wants to use Lansing sort of as an anchor point, because that's going to be kind of where a lot of her base is lying. She really emphasized that this is not an issue of partisanship, but that she emphasized the theme of public service in her announcement and the idea that someone needs to serve their country, which I think will appeal to people who are big fans of Mike Rogers because of his commitment to national security. And I think that that's really going to be crucial for her, is to show that she's engaged with the public in ways that Mike Bishop has not been.
All right. Since we all sat down last time, there has been a reset, quote-unquote reset, with the part-time legislature initiative undertaken by Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. I was looking at the board where we all kind of said what we think is going to happen to this thing in the long run. And I think, Jacob, you and I said it's not going to make the ballot. Mike and Simon here, you both said it was going to make the ballot. Is anybody ready to change their vote in light of the reset?
I am not. And my original yes vote was with the caveat of exactly what happened last week, which is that the ballot language would be reworded and reamended. Because I think that it would be unlike the people at play here to let stubbornness get the best of them and forge ahead with something that might have a policy proposal that might have this many holes in it.
Jacob?
Well, I said no, and I continue to say that because I'm going to go back to what the lieutenant governor said in his rationale when it looked like he was going to abandon any chance of getting his language approved to form, which is still the case with this new language. It's clear, and he's pointed this out, that there have been multiple attacks from all sides on the language, and he's obviously cast that as the Lansing establishment trying to undermine him. And so my point in saying that is that whether the language is reworked, whether it's not, it was going to face some kind of opposition. Someone is going to try to craft something to get in under the language in some way and make some kind of argument to cast some doubt. And as the lieutenant governor said, it will most likely end up in court. And they still are running the risk of not getting the language itself approved to form, which has always been considered kind of the legal, go-to standard for going out before you even go out into the field. And so they rework the language and reassure us with a reset that it's going to be fine, but they're still not doing kind of one of those basic hurdles of doing a ballot question.
Okay. Are you still thinking it's going to make the ballot, Mike?
I'm going to stick with my original, but it does show a level of disorganization that I think is a little surprising for the lieutenant governor.
But. Okay. I was a no. I'm gonna hold on no. Maybe even increase my bet on no. I do think I agree with you, Mike. I think it shows an issue that they have. I think they're gonna lose a lot of momentum. I think when he first announced in Mackinac Island, there was a certain amount of excitement about it. I think when you say to people, all right, go out for a month or so, collect all these signatures, but oh shoot, we're gonna have to throw them all away. I think there are gonna be people who may have really bought into that campaign are going to say, oh, forget about it. I'm going to spend my summer doing what I want to do because clearly this isn't a very well organized or well run campaign. So I'm going to continue to stick on no.
I will say this though, John, if I am ultimately proved wrong and it does not make the ballot, I don't think it'll be for a lack of public support, but rather as an organizational failure, much like Mike was saying. And I think it still remains to be seen how that's going to reflect on the lieutenant governor if that ends up coming to pass.
Mike, the legislature's coming back on Wednesday for the first time since the holiday break. Well, obviously, one of the big question marks is this good jobs proposal. What do you think the odds of the House moving on this package are?
I can't give you odds. I really can't give you odds. What I heard today surprised me a little bit. I hear that Speaker Tom Leonard and the governor have not met yet to discuss this, and they're scheduled to meet, quote unquote, very soon, but in that they haven't even begun to talk and sort out their differences. I don't know what that means. The governor's 10 to 15 votes short. He's got to get some votes from the Democratic side. As we've said in the newsletter previously, he's looking to the Democrats. He's looking to the Detroit delegation to pick up votes. If he continues to be at odds with his own Republican caucus, I don't know what this means for his for the prospects for his bill. At this point, I can't even tell you if it will come up Wednesday or if they'll be doing something else.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that actually moves or if it's just going to be kind of stuck there for the summer.
I think, John, that this has really important implications for sort of the ideological direction that the party has taken. We see Governor Snyder, who's acting as kind of a traditional moderate Republican, who is by all means pro-business, at odds with a caucus who has moved toward a strain of principled conservatism that doesn't necessarily view business with the same mindset that his more moderate and establishment-minded colleagues may. And I think that the fact that it's been such a struggle to find these votes really kind of underscores that strain of ideology of that conservatism that has taken root in the legislature, that this is a view of policymaking and government that's here to stay.
The interesting thing about this, though, is these credits have always been tough to get passed. I mean, I remember way back when they first started bringing up the single business tax credits in the 90s, towards the end of the Engler administration, and there was never a lot of love in Republican caucuses for these credits. They passed from a pragmatic standpoint, but there's a lot of conservatives that just don't see the need to sort of quote-unquote buy jobs. They believe much more in the gardening approach to economic development, where you create the best climate you can for jobs, but you don't offer these huge rich dollar offerings to lure companies. That it's you're picking winners and losers by doing so, and that's an anathema to conservatives. So,
yeah, and just going back to what the dynamics have been playing out since the alleged deal making that the governor is doing. I mean, so obviously the governor wants this more than anything. I mean, he put out a Detroit News editorial, and he called attention to that in a message from his RPA PAC today. So the governor will work with the Democrats to get this done, I'm very sure. It's just the kind of question is what deals will be allowed to be made, which apparently the Republicans could have control on. I mean, if Speaker Leonard is upset with what is going on, I mean, he obviously has the ability to control the board, right? So while the Democrats have the ability to make deals to get the governor the votes, it's going to be a question of what is going to be palatable to be made so that carries Republicans and Democrats to deliver this package.
All right. We've got Mike Alimo with us for today's podcast from King Clean Fuels Michigan. Tell us a little bit about your group and how did it start? What's your primary focus?
Absolutely. Thank you for letting me join you today, this beautiful Michigan day. Clean Fuels Michigan started a couple of years ago, was basically the evolution of a different advocacy group. And you had a number of Michigan companies that decided they wanted a more direct advocacy focus, and so had approached Acuitas, the multi-client lobbying firm in town, to house that group within their firm. And ultimately, I was approached back in October because as the market and issues had continued to heat up, they were looking for an executive director to work on the association full-time. And so I started back in October and have been with the member since.
Okay. Give us an idea of who your members are.
So I enjoy quite a diverse client membership. Our members are everywhere from the utility groups, automakers, auto suppliers, fleet owners and operators, and we even have environmental groups and strategic partnerships with other coalitions that have seen advanced mobility as kind of the next space for clean energy.
Talk a little bit for us about the current status of the role of electric cars. Is it happening as fast as you originally thought?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we at, and when do you see that as sort of a major force? Because they're only, what, 6 sure. or 10% right now in the market?
Not even that. Yeah, the electric vehicles represent about 2.5% of the U.S. market. And there's a great deal of debate on you know, where the status of electric vehicles are. Clean Fuels Michigan believes that electric vehicles are experiencing really a never-before-seen inflection point in the market. You're seeing adoption rates increase by hundreds of percent a year, and that growth is in the face of, you know, the ubiquitous and prevalent market for conventional oil and gas. And so despite those hurdles, you are seeing adoption rates like you've never seen before. That doesn't mean there aren't challenges in place. You know, production costs, you know, battery production costs, R&D technology costs, all of these things, you know, are emerging in the market, lowering the cost of electric vehicles. But, you know, in Michigan, we're looking at around 10,000 electric vehicles in the state. That's, you know, about average for our population size. But we think we can do much better. And certainly in terms of bringing infrastructure into place, we think that Michigan needs to do a lot more.
Yeah, how short are we falling when it comes to the implementation of infrastructure for electric vehicles?
Sure. The numbers aren't great. Infrastructure, we are doing, we are just kind of breaking even, if you will. We have infrastructure in place within those pockets that there tend to be more electric vehicles. Across the nation, in looking at alternative fuel vehicles, the numbers get much worse. We're 41st in the nation for alternative fuel vehicle deployment. And, you know, we're one of a very few number of states that have no regulatory climate that incentivizes alternative fuel vehicles. So 37 other states have a regulatory climate that in some way incentivizes alternative fuel vehicles, and Michigan's not one of them. And we think that, you know, 41st ranking has something to do with that.
And you're not just talking about electric vehicles, but also compressed natural gas and propane, correct?
That's right. That's right. We advocate for anything other than conventional oil and gas. So that would include propane, natural gas, hydrogen fuel cell, ethanol, biodiesel, you know, all of those things fall within our umbrella. In Michigan, you're really seeing, you know, the markets flourish more recently around the three applications of electrification, propane, and natural gas, as you mentioned.
Yep. So what would be an incentivized market for the use of electric vehicles and alternative fuels look like in terms of legislative package, regulatory changes? Do you need both to kind of create that atmosphere to incentivize the use?
That's a great question. It really is kind of, you know, from our perspective, a diverse approach that's needed. There's not a silver bullet here. I think, as we all know, being the automotive capital of the world, it's incredibly expensive to bring a car to market. It's also a very, very highly regulated market. So there are a lot of challenges across the board in place. On the regulatory front, one of the things that is currently going on is the Michigan Public Service Commission is going to be hosting a technical conference to discuss electric vehicle infrastructure. Clean Fuels Michigan is playing a prominent role in that. Later today, we are hosting a roundtable discussion at DTE's headquarters in Detroit, bringing together stakeholders that represent the utilities, the automakers, and the EVSEs, which are the charging manufacturers, and bringing them all together to begin building consensus around what a state model should look like. How can we incentivize a competitive marketplace for charging infrastructure? Working well with utilities, because at the end of the day, it has to come from the grid, and really continuing to build out this infrastructure so that as these vehicles continue to become adopted, that they're going to have places that they can charge. Another side of this need is the fact that autonomous vehicles are going to be electric vehicles. They need the electrical output that a battery can provide in order to host the massive amount of technology that's going to be on board. And so, for us, we see this again as something that's not too far away in the future, and we need to be accommodating that. On the side of legislation, certainly alternative fuel vehicles, they're great. They reduce our carbon footprint. They help improve our air quality in Michigan, which needs improvement. But they are expensive, and there's an incremental cost involved with the technology. And so we are looking at ways to reduce that incremental cost in the form of a tax credit that will go towards incentivizing folks to purchase those vehicles. And a few different ways to look at that. If you're looking at an electric vehicle, well, that's kind of an individual credit that would go towards incentivizing someone to purchase a vehicle. But on the heavier duty applications for a propane or compressed natural gas, that can really be seen as a business tax cut, because these are businesses that are going to be investing in their fleets to convert over to a cleaner fuel source. And they're going to be looking at, opportunities to do that. And over the long run, save money because the fuel is cheaper.
One of the questions I want to ask you is, one of the issues we've been following here is sort of the dispute involving Tesla. I'm sure you've been tracking that.
Sure.
Did you guys have to weigh in on that, or did you kind of just sort of let the parties duke that out?
Yeah, in terms of the point of purchase issue, we're certainly staying out of that. It's yet to be seen how that really unfolds. But Tesla's doing some great stuff in the market. I mean, you can argue a lot at the end of the day about their market capitalization and whether they should be valued more than Ford or GM, although I believe GM did take over again last week as the most highly valued automaker in the U.S. But, there's no question that Tesla spearheaded a lot of, the draw and kind of niche market for electric vehicles. And that's been an important part of those adoption rates. They also have heavily invested in infrastructure. And so, in Michigan, we have, I think it's something like 12 Tesla superchargers. They're building another 9. And so that's an important aspect. And it's important in Michigan because, of our geography. We're a large state where, a lot of folks in the southern end of the peninsula have houses or want to go up north, the northern end. They need to make sure that they can get there using an electric vehicle. And so, again, just, that infrastructure is very important. But Tesla is, recently they're finding out how difficult it is to make these cars. And so while the interest is there, I think they had something like 400,000 pre-orders for their Tesla Model 3. They need to make sure they can seal the deal and deliver on that. So It is yet to be seen. GM is doing some great work. They got the Bolt out early, and we're going to be seeing it in all 50 states in December, so we're really excited about that.
But just to kind of go back to what John was asking, wouldn't you argue that, I know you said you want to stay out of it, wouldn't you argue that allowing Tesla to sell directly to customers in Michigan is part of the equation or step towards, you know, encouraging the use of alternative fuels and electric vehicles, which is part of your organization's goals?
I think that anytime you can reduce barriers to get to incentivize consumer purchase, you know, that's going to increase your adoption rates. But I think in Michigan, we haven't, you know, we've looked at, I mean, you don't have any problem in coming across a Tesla driving down the road. They're getting here. They're not getting them here in Michigan. They're having to travel to other states. But you know, again, it's a different space than what I traditionally work in. You know, for us, it's very important. I'm looking at kind of those regulatory burdens that are affecting all automakers or that are affecting all alternative fuel vehicle types, and so that we can, you know, really, you know, kind of, you know, the whole idea that rising tide raises all ships. You know, we're looking at policy solutions that really do that for alternative fuel vehicles across the board.
I'm going to ask you to put on your or bring out your crystal ball for us.
Sure.
Obviously, you've studied this issue a lot. Is there a point in time in the not too distant future you can see this as a sort of a turning point? And I guess how far away do you think that is?
Sure. It's a great question. I think that, and I mentioned this earlier, autonomous vehicle technology was, I think, in some ways a game changer for electric vehicles. You know, we'll see how the technology develops and how consumers adopt that technology. But as we have seen the trajectory of autonomous vehicle technology move to the 3 to 5 year window, and we've seen how that aligns very closely with what we've seen for the trajectory for electric vehicles, I think that, you know, we're looking at as soon as, you know, 2020, 2021, that we're going to be seeing mass levels of adoption for electric vehicles. And again, we need to be prepared for that. There needs to be infrastructure in place to do it. There are also global trends that need to be mentioned as well. You know, France announcing the ban on gas and diesel vehicles by 2040. Norway is looking at it. Netherlands are looking at it. China is heavily incentivizing next energy vehicles, as they term them, because of how atrocious their air quality is. Mm-hmm. There was a recent Detroit News article that stated that, you know, China's doing it because of that, but that's not as big of a problem in the United States. And I would beg to differ. You know, I think that we have half of Americans, according to the American Lung Association, that are breathing in air that is detrimental to their health. That's a problem. You have, you know, almost one out of every six Detroiters with asthma. That's a problem. You have the West Coast, you know, in the Muskegon area and such, with really poor air quality issues. Some of the worst in the state. It's not entirely their fault. The wind patterns are bringing that pollution from Chicago and Milwaukee and other places. But needless to say, you know, this is all pointing to this idea that we need to be doing something about this. It's important.
So electric vehicles, you know, are really have a lot of application in the city and in urban areas because they have kind of limited range and there's more charging stations available. What do you do to kind of expand these technologies to more rural areas so that when you look at people who are, you know, have a country lifestyle, that they're not getting left behind by this technological revolution?
Yeah, that's a great question and a good opportunity to talk a little bit more about electric vehicles. So there are three types of electric vehicles. You've got the battery electric vehicles, the ones that run solely on battery. Then you've got the plug-in electrics. Those are your hybrids, and those are those that probably have some kind of gas application along with it, but are using an energy motor or a electric motor as well. And then you have what's this third, more newly developed class, and that's the high capacity. So you have the Tesla, now you have the Bolt, and you have a number of these batteries that have this higher range capacity on them. On the infrastructure side, you know, we need to be looking at roadside high capacity or what's considered DC fast charging infrastructure. It's capital intensive, but in terms of addressing the idea of range anxiety, it's incredibly important. There's also a lot to be said for adoption rates when it comes to roadside charging. People driving down the road, seeing roadside charging available to them is important when it comes to their decision-making process and looking at an electric vehicle. And studies have shown that if you are a person that sees this roadside charging or even workplace charging available to you, you're 20 times more likely to purchase an electric vehicle. And so, a person right now walks into a dealership looking for a new car, 30% of them are looking at or considering an electric vehicle. Now, only something like 3 to 5% of them actually pull the trigger. Now, why is that? And again, looking at all those other studies, it really shows the infrastructure matters, access matters, in order for consumers to feel comfortable with adopting a new technology.
All right, Mike, one last question. How difficult has this kind of two-year glut in oil and the very low fuel prices? I mean, I think I saw on Grand Ledge $1.96 a gallon this past weekend. How difficult has that made the sort of the mission and the growth pattern for electric vehicles?
Sure. There's no question it's a challenge. America is experiencing almost a renaissance in production, and there are some places in the country that are benefiting from that. Michigan, the Midwest states are benefiting from a glut in natural gas, and so for us, that's an important part of utilizing it as an auto fuel. But long term, we all know that the prices will not remain as low as they are, and that is probably the number one reason we have businesses that are looking at a propane or natural gas application to begin with. They know that the price of propane or natural gas is incredibly stable, and that price stability helps them determine their costs years down the road. They don't know that for oil, especially diesel. Diesel price is very subject to events across the globe, and so something happens in a faraway country that could cause a spike in the price of diesel, and that's not good for businesses here. So long term, we see this as really just a small hiccup, and the technology for propane and natural gas and electrification has matured to the point where it is viable on its own, and we know that down in the future, as the price of oil and gas rises, so too will the adoption rates of these alternative fuel vehicles.
All right. Thank you, Michael Imo, for joining us, informing us about Clean Fuels Michigan and sort of the future that we're looking at as far as transportation. Appreciate it.
Thank you again so much for having me.
All right, guys, that's a wrap for this week. That was a very interesting conversation, I thought, with Mr. Limo about electric cars. Anybody here interested in running an electric car or operating an electric car? I mean, Simon, your new car is kind of electric.
Yeah, I recently bought a Toyota Prius, and I was considering their plug-in option. But the thing is that I realized is that I live downtown Lansing, and that if I had bought the plug-in option, I wouldn't have anywhere to plug it in.
See, well, so, great example of the infrastructure that Verge Bonero clearly needs to work on for the city of Lansing.
Well, I didn't get a chance to bring up the conversation, but just remembering off the top of my head, pretty sure you can plug in by the city market, and also there's a random one in the chamber, maybe the Chamber of Commerce parking lot, which I don't think worked. I had my fiance's dad try to park his car there, and I don't think it worked, so we went back over to the city market. So those are the only two I can think off the top of my head downtown.
Would you ever drive an electric car?
Sure, I would, but right now my car is paid for, and so it's free transportation. I'm just going to keep driving.
There you go. And I was telling Mike that after our interview that I'll be ready for an electric vehicle when I can get one that will actually take me all the way up to the UP and tow a boat. And he wasn't willing to give me a date when that would be possible.
What about an electric motorcycle, John? Does that interest you?
No. No.
I was thinking of your other forms of transportation.
No, I'll stick with the petroleum-burning, loud, stinky Harley-Davidson motorcycle that I have.
And I think if you're riding a motorcycle down the highway, the last thing you want to be is silent.
That's true. What do they say? Loud pipes save lives. Well, with that, we'll thank our podcast sponsor, AT&T of Michigan, and we'll talk to you next week.